Welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the classicist is Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, this is the first time that you and I have had a chance to get back together since the outbreak of, in some cases, protests, in some cases, near riots in reaction to the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And one of the things that's interesting about this, if you just woke up from a coma and were trying to take this all in, you'd probably think that this was a rerun of a situation like Ferguson, where the public was polarized and there was a real disagreement about the underlying facts of this case. In this instance, it's almost impossible to find anyone who is loudly defending the behavior of the police officer in this case. He was brought up on charges almost immediately. The authorities in Minnesota have since upped those charges. So what do you make of the fact that despite there being such quick attempts to find a remedy here and such sweeping support for it, we have nevertheless seen a reaction like this one in our major cities?
Well, I think they have to be seen in the larger context that the initial protest, as you say, was shared by everybody because the knee and the 8 minutes, it was beyond the moral and ethical pale. But it morphed into a whole different agenda within 48 hours. And it was violent, and there was arson and looting. And then suddenly it was like 1792 to 1794 with the Committee on Public Safety. It was just the reign of terror, the agendas. We ended up with NPR, you know, advising us to get rid of our white authors on our bookshelf, to defund the police, to girls cutting their hair off because they were ashamed of their so-called whiteness. But that was crazy, and it happened very quickly. And why was that? Much more quickly than Occupy Wall Street or even Me Too, that kind of late stage hysteria. And I think the answer was, it's an election year. A, B, Donald Trump is a very controversial figure. C, they had tried to derail his reelection efforts through Mueller, 25th Amendment. We've talked about this, impeachment, the COVID, the lockdown became politicized. So very quickly, people saw that this was the magic bullet that would get rid of the Trump werewolf and the way that the other things had all failed. And that was weaponized. And then I think people in the Democratic Party had thought that they had escaped the hard left because they had neutralized or emasculated Bernie. They kind of bought off all the other candidates in the sense that Elizabeth Warren and Buttigieg and Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, they all dropped out mysteriously to let Biden be the sole candidate. Mike Bloomberg kind of failed. But they didn't realize that that agenda is still there, the AOC wing, if that's the right term, and it's back now and it's dominant. And they'd sort of said, well, these people accept Joe Biden and they accept a centrist candidate and they want to win. And the answer was no, they're really angry. They're still there. And so they had a political agenda. You add it all up and it was just too much to expect that it would be quiet and reasonable.
Let's talk about how the media has handled this. There's a lot to discuss here, but maybe we should work backwards from the most recent development, which is just kind of remarkable. So the New York Times last week ran an op-ed by Senator Tom Cotton in which he suggested the use of the military in areas with severe unrest where they otherwise couldn't potentially get the situation under control. And we should note that this is not some novel Caesarism of Cotton's creation. There is clear statutory authority for the president to do that. George H.W. Bush did it during the L.A. riots. But this nevertheless engenders a huge backlash within the New York Times amongst the staff that culminates a few days ago with the resignation of their opinion editor for having had the temerity to even publish this point of view. So, Victor, what does this tell us about where the media is at this point?
Well, I don't think it's a media if we define it in classical terms. Remember Jim Rutenberg, when Trump was elected, the New York Times writer said that you could not be dispassionate. We've talked about this, and that was echoed by everybody from Christiane Amanpour to Jorge Ramos, that he was so beyond the pale that you had to be a beyond the pale yourself and not to print, quote unquote, his lies. So that was the the particulars and the general, we've been in this new age of postmodernism that doesn't believe in disinterested inquiry, and there are such things as facts. It's all conditioned on power structures and who has authority, and then they create truth. So they don't want any fairness because they feel they're in an existential struggle. And that's whether it's the Philadelphia paper, the New York paper, or NPR or PBS. And that's pretty much the explanation, except there's this other element, and that is the demographic. We've had a lot of immigration. The demographics are different. So a lot of what I would call old white liberals from the 60s, and they keep referring to their student protest days or their civil rights days, they got it in their head that the revolution wouldn't devour them. And by that, I mean, once they started mouthing these agendas that your superficial appearance defines your persona, it's essential, it's not incidental to your character, they assume that they got immunity and they could live the good life and have all the power and influence. And because they were so liberal and progressive, they had created indemnity insurance. And now they're learning that this 50, 60, 70-year-old white liberal caste is being devoured by the people they created, in the sense of the diversity politics movement, the identity politics. And, you know, Euripides wrote a good play called The Bacchae, and in it, Tiresias, an older establishmentarian, and King Cadmus, they want to get into the cult of Dionysus, and they're too old, but so they dress up in these ridiculous fawn skins and thyrsi, and they really believe they're hip, and they're portrayed as ridiculous. And that's what this white liberal class has been for some time. They're ridiculous because they're renouncing everything they've held so they can ingratiate themselves on the principle they won't be attacked. You saw it with Joe Biden when he went into, well before the mayor of Minneapolis's walk of shame, or well before FBI agents taking the knee, or medical professionals saying, you know, medically it's okay to break the lockdown now because racism is a greater threat than COVID. Well before that, Joe Biden, remember in that key debate, said, busing, I was wrong, and the sentencing, I was wrong. And he pretty much announced Joe Biden of the 1980s and 90s.
To this point, you were quick to point out the class element of this, especially in a piece that you wrote at American Greatness. And this is namely that some of the people, A, behind the more violent aspects of the protests, and B, some of the people who were supporting them but not actively participating, and here we're talking especially about celebrities, have a very different standard for their own communities than for the ones where the protests are taking place. Make that case for us.
Well, just off the top of my head, when the police are defunded and they're out of a job, they're going to make a lot more money as private security guards for the mayors of these cities and Barbara Streisand and all of these grandees that are urging defunded police and Cher. So they'll be taken care of. The people who are going to be hurt are the people who don't have the capital or the income to hire a private security guard. But yeah, there is a class and racial element, and they're connected. I mean, it's very weird to see these kind of upper middle class privileged white kids that go into hysterics when they're arrested, as if, you know, they don't want a felony indictment on their law school application resume. And then the shock troops, as they see it, are inner city youth that can be lured into looting because inner city youth in the Antifa's white supremacist mindset, they love to loot, so let's put them out there on TV for shock value, and then we'll get in these little costumes that we wear and go back and, as the brains of the operation, point people to the next door or deface a World War II monument or plot strategy. You know, it's almost as if you think, well, wait a minute, where's proportional representation and disparate impact? Can't you have some people of color in your ranks that reflect proportional representation in the population? So that's bad. And then you have the white liberal class. And these are people who are very complex in their thinking about race. And to boil it down or to reduce it to maybe a simplistic exegesis, it works something like this. I live in Atherton, or I live in Woodside, or I live in the Upper West Side, and my children are so important to me, they have to go to Sacred Heart, or they have to go to Sidwell Friends. I'm not going to short their futures by my principles. And, you know, I just have a beautiful home. I love gardening, and we did our kitchen, and I play by, I just don't, I have to live in a good neighborhood. And when you add all of these compromises up, it boils down to, I don't want my kids in any school, anywhere, shape, or form near an inner city youth. I just don't want to do it. I do not want to walk in that neighborhood. I don't want to be socializing with those people, and I feel guilty about it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a superstructure, psychological, rhetorical, whatever term we want to use, and it goes something like this. This is a racist, sick society. It's endemic. Donald Trump brought it. He caused it. And you really saw that with, and it's not just white. And Michelle Obama said, you can't be too angry enough. So spoke Zarathustra from her, what, Martha Vineyard, $12 million estate. So I think everybody's kind of getting disgusted of this elite class fanning the flames with the assumption that their rhetoric never has to be matched by deeds. I understand why they do it. I put all three of my kids in a school that was about 90% Hispanic, and it was very tough, and this is the lowest per capita income area in the state and almost the country. And you do pay a price if you're, you know, you don't, you say to yourself, it's good for kids to see and live and talk, and you too with the underclass. But there's prices to that. I mean, I'm listening to gunfire every night around my farm, and it's mostly Mexican-American people practicing their handguns for when the revolution comes to take them, but they're going to go out with a fight. Or, and then I have gangs and everything. So it's not easy to do, and I sometimes have regrets, but I really don't give sermons to people about how enlightened I am. I don't think a lot of people do. They just go live their lives. But this Pelosi class, this Dianne Feinstein class, this, I don't know what we would call it, the mayor of Fry, or the governor of Minnesota, Waltz, or Cuomo, their lives don't even approximate the rhetoric. You listen to their rhetoric, you think they're Antifa, you know, architects. And then when you look at how they live and what their value is, it's Nancy Pelosi getting on TV podcast bragging about all the $10 a pint ice cream that her $20,000 refrigerator holds.
You wrote recently at National Review about the fact that after the issue was raised of getting the military involved in some of the cities with the most disorder, there was a parade of former generals and admirals who came out and publicly criticized the president. First amongst them in status, of course, our Hoover colleague and President Trump's former Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis. And you warned that this is a potentially dangerous game for those former senior officials to be playing. Walk us through that argument.
Well, I know some of the generals, and their objections have been pretty prominent in a way that we've never seen before the last 2 years. And then all of a sudden, at a time when these protests were reaching a crescendo, they all came out. I mean, Allen came out, and Mattis came out, and Mullen came out, and McCaffrey was back, and McRaven. I could go on. And so I said, if you really don't believe that the Code of Military Conduct, which prohibits all disparagement of the commander-in-chief while you're in active service, doesn't apply to you because you're retired, and it does say in the code, retired generals are subject to that. But let's say it's like the Logan Act. Then at least you could obey a few common principles of decency, given that you haven't been elected anything and that you have enormous power at your disposal, even in a retirement capacity. And given that the left has always been after you for corporate lobbying, serving on defense contractor boards, using your security clearances to monetize positions on television, et cetera, et cetera. So what were those? And there were two general ones. They were at the end of the essay, but I said, essentially, you have to be, you know, disinterested. You have to say, I'm shocked at Donald Trump because he violated the Constitution, and I was shocked at Barack Obama when he weaponized the IRS or he gun ran into Mexico and refused a congressional subpoena, or he weaponized the IRS and went after his opponents, or he had a quid pro quo in Seoul where he basically dismantled missile defense in Eastern Europe to get space for his election, or he hired his DOJ and FBI and CIA was intimately involved with a foreign national, Christopher Steele, to subvert first a campaign, then a transition, then a presidency. And we know now from the Inspector General's report and released documents from the Director of National Intelligence that the Obama administration officials doctored evidence, they destroyed evidence, they diluted a FISA court, they leaked redacted names to the media, which is a felony. They conducted an ambush, basically a perjury ambush of the National Security Advisor. And they inserted informants into a political campaign. And all of them are being investigated by federal attorneys. So my point was, if they're worried about the Constitution, A, they have to be symmetrical. They weren't. If they're worried about the Constitution, they have to get details where he violated. And they just said mockery, violation, worst thing ever. But they didn't tell us it's illegal for a president in extremists to use federal troops because Lincoln, Madison, Cleveland, I mean, everybody knows they all did it. And then I got more specific and suggested that if they're not going to be symmetrical and they're not going to cite evidence, they at least shouldn't, they should, as people of responsibility, not reduce the argument to Hitler. But of course, they couldn't resist that. And so Mattis, whom I like and is a colleague, first thing he said was that Trump was dividing the country in the way that the Nazis who opposed us on D-Day had divided, as if Donald Trump is responsible for a war that killed 60 million people. Or earlier, Hayden, CIA director, four-star general, had tweeted out pictures of Auschwitz and Bergenthal as if Trump had killed 6 million people. That's a mockery, to use his term and Mattis's, of the whole Holocaust. And then we had McCaffrey saying that, oh, he canceled the subscription to the Washington Post. He's Mussolini. So they did that. And then the second thing is, if you're an officer, retired general of that importance, you surely wouldn't wink and nod that you might seek extra legal methodologies to get rid of a president. But that's exactly what they did. McRaven said, sooner the better he leaves. What does that mean? What does a person on duty think when he hears a retired admiral and the architect of getting bin Laden say, sooner the better? And then Mattis said, we can unite without him. We have to resist him. What does that mean? You elected head of state that's running the country, you're going to go around him, unite with a shadow government? And then McCaffrey, and the rest of them. And the worst was Allen. Allen said, in January 1 marks the point where Trump ended the American experiment. So if he ended the American experiment, then what is he? He's a traitor. And then what do you do about a traitor in the White House? And then I also suggested they at least have to be factually correct. When Mattis said, and I think this is tragic because it's going to be an infamous albatross around his neck, when he characterized the protests as a small number of people who turned violent, 2,000, arrests in New York alone. I think there's 140 police that have been shot, killed, or wounded, or brutalized, multi-billion dollars of property sent down from downtown Santa Monica to Philadelphia to Manhattan to Washington, D.C. And when he characterized that as a small number, that was factually incorrect, as was everything from Mullen saying they're using tear gas to Trump was going to mobilize 10,000 people and send them into the cities, etc. And then finally, and you alluded to this, do it individually. Because what's scary is when retired officers with security clearances and enormous amounts of contact within the Pentagon come out in unison and they say these things in the manner that they said them, then people they're worried, and I'm worried, especially when one of their confidants and heroines, Rosa Brooks, who was a State Department lawyer 10 days after Trump was elected in Foreign Policy, very prestigious liberal magazine, wrote a long essay, Three Ways to Get Rid of the President, Trump. One, say that he's crazy and get rid of him right now with the 25th Amendment. Two, that doesn't work, impeach him. Three, if impeachment doesn't work, then I would never think I would say it, she wrote, but let's think about a military coup. Let's get officers either to remove him or say, sir, I'm not going to obey that order. And so, yeah, I think that they did the country a lot of damage. I don't know if they meant to, but they were very dangerous, and they never brought any facts, details. They were not symmetrical in their criticism. They used a level of invective that was unbecoming of an officer.
The last thing that I'll ask you, just kind of playing this forward, we're now at a stage where the protests are moving from being mostly reactive to trying to push an affirmative agenda. And in the past few days, as you suggested earlier, the big idea we've been hearing is defunding police departments. And people are arguing, in some cases prevaricating, over what that means. The undiluted version is actually abolishing police departments, which is an idea that has actually been floating around certain parts of the hard left for a while. But the sanitized version is, well, we'll keep the police, but we're going to reallocate a lot of their funds to various community and social services. And this is not, we've already seen, purely aspirational. You've already had Eric Garcetti, the mayor of Los Angeles, say that the city's going to take $150 million out of the LAPD budget and give it to those kinds of groups. In Minneapolis, there is what looks to be a veto-proof majority on the city council that is in support of some version of defunding. And, you know, Victor, as I said earlier, the underlying argument about George Floyd is one where there seemed to be initially, in large measure, a consensus of public opinion. Defunding police departments, probably not so much consensus there. So what does this look like, both on the ground, but also in terms of the political consequences, if the advocates keep going in this direction?
Well, it's incoherent because although we all agree there's racism in the country because we're a multiracial society that are good but not perfect, it's based on this idea, as the protesters say and the organizers say, black people are being killed every day. Well, last year there were 9 people who were unarmed that were African-American that were shot by police. It's about half the number of white people who are unarmed shot by the police. It's double their numbers on the population, but not double their numbers of those who were arrested. If you're saying, well, white people themselves are killing black men, well, then we have about 500,000 cases, which are rare when you add up the millions of crimes, but 500,000 cases of interracial violence. They go 5-1, black on white, not white on black. So we're searching for the data that shows that what this tragedy of George Floyd was typical rather than rare, and we can't find it. And we think, well, why was Black Lives formed? It was largely grew out of 3 Marxists who were angry over 2 incidents, the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman. That was a private dispute or altercation between a Hispanic neighborhood watchman and an African-American teenager. There was no so-called, by the New York Times definition, there was no white involvement. In fact, we know there wasn't, because they invented a new word called white Hispanic to strain the definition. And the other was Ferguson. And Ferguson, from Barack Obama's exhaustive Eric Holder Attorney General investigation, we learned that he never said, hands up, don't shoot, and that he was charging a police officer. So those incidents sparked this entire movement, which is, it's not empirical. So that's the problem. The essential problem is that they don't have any data. It's just rage. Okay, so they're angry at the larger society that has disparities economically, but then we achieved 3% growth for African Americans. We got family income up that was stagnant after 10 years. We got unemployment to the record low, 5.4% for African Americans. Things were getting much better, not worse. And that doesn't register. So then we say, well, defund the police, and that would be for what reason? Where do the police usually go? They say they go to the inner city and they brutalize people. Well, we've already got rid of stop and frisk. The broken windows concept is ancient history. Nobody's following that anymore. And crime is starting to creep back up, especially in places like California, where enforcement's very lax. But it's hurting the inner city. Okay, well, if that's a decision that these blue states can make, because all of we're talking about, Troy, are blue state phenomena. They are mayors that are Democratic, governors, Democratic, state attorney general, usually police chief, many of them black, and many of them black and female. And so their paradigm is what they're dealing with. If they want to democratically disband the police, that's their prerogative. And I think most of the country says now that we're reached a point now where it's just futile to argue with you. All we ask is you do it in a democratic fashion, either a plebiscite or a city council vote, and then you leave us out of it and you don't ask us to fund the consequences. Because the consequences are going to be higher crime, and we had already during the lockdown and lessened police profile, we had 25 people shot in Chicago and killed in 36 hours, or less than 36 hours. 25, I think, killed in about 30 hours. And you know what's going to happen when they start to lay off these police officers? They're not going to be unemployed. They're going to be hired. And they're going to be hired by whom? They're going to be hired by people in the Upper West Side, people in Atherton, people in Palos Verdes Estates, people in Malibu, to the extent they're not already hired there. And the people in the inner city are going to have no police and no money to hire a private security guard. One of my biggest, strongest, I have two strong memories of being pulled over by law enforcement the last 4 years. Once leaving Pepperdine, where I was teaching a class, and getting a phone call and pulling over in front of Barbara Streisand's estate. Not on her estate, by it. And within 2 seconds, an armed security guard tapped on my window and started interrogating. The other was I gave a lecture up to a very nice area of Piedmont. And as I drove into Piedmont, I didn't see an Oakland officer, but I was tailed by two private security cars. And I got out to go into a private residence, and a person rolled down his window and said, "I hope you have an invitation, because we haven't seen you in this neighborhood before." So that's what we're looking at. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny because the left is so adamantly against charter schools and homeschooling, private schooling, and yet they're going to create the tradition. We're going to have a private police force and a very weak, anemic public one, if at all, in the places where it's needed most.
You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read all of Victor's work at victorhanson.com, and he's on Twitter at VDHanson. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.